jam. Got me running round in circles, grinning upside down. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our Zoom meeting tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing.
I'm an alcoholic, and by His grace, I'm sober. My name's Michelle. Welcome, everybody, to a really cool Zoom meeting. You're about to hear a really wonderful speaker that I love very much. I know she has a passion for God, for AA, for her family. I know that she's worked the steps and continues to work the steps and sponsors many women. You're in for a treat from my special friend, Kelly.
I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Kelly Phillips. It's always a pleasure, I think, to tell my story. I enjoy speaking and telling my story. I think it's great. I love to talk about all the things that God has done in my life, how He's brought me from a place of darkness into a place of light. And I think it's just truly amazing to sit in a room full of miracles and just talk about all the things that God has done for us while we were, you know, dead in the ditch. So I grew up in Michigan, just outside of Detroit, with my parents and my sister. And, I mean, we weren't like dirt poor, but we didn't have a lot. My parents both worked two jobs growing up. And my sister and I were just kind of left to be at home and raise ourselves. And so, we watched a lot of TV. I mean, we did stupid stuff in the summertime because we didn't really have a lot of supervision. So that's kind of the way it was. Alcoholism does run in my family. I'm not the anomaly, you know. There's a bunch of us crazy people. And so my mother grew up in an alcoholic home. Both of her parents were drunk until she was about 12 or so. And then her mom found Alcoholics Anonymous and actually remarried another man that was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the idea that I had of AA was sober people. Like, I didn't know anybody that was actually drunk. And so they didn't really share a lot of that with us growing up. Like, they didn't say alcoholism runs in your family, or you might have the gene or anything like that. We never really even talked about it. My grandparents, I know, like, every Thanksgiving they would leave and go to a meeting, and then they would come back and we'd have pie. You know, that was just kind of, and I would say, where are they going? And my mom would be like, that's not really any of your business. And you know, there's also a few alcoholics in my dad's side of the family, and so the disease of alcoholism is very prevalent. Although neither of my parents were alcoholics, they definitely had their own issues from suffering from coming in contact with the people that were alcoholics in their lives. And, yeah, they shared that with us. You know, it was in their parenting, and it was just kind of the way that it was raised. And so because of that, my mom was very angry. When I was a child, she was very angry, and she had a lot of unprocessed stuff, and so she was very much fly off the handle, and you just wanted to try and be on her good side. But I apparently didn't get the memo because I was the bad child. I didn't really fit in with people. I tried really hard to try and fit in with people, but I just always felt like people were talking about me. Like, I felt like they felt and could sense what I felt. And I felt it separate. I felt not a part of, and I felt disconnected. And I always felt like I was trying to like spin my wheels really hard just to like be connected with the people that I was trying to be friends with. And that's just kind of how I grew up. I mean, I was that kid that was in elementary school that was failing classes and had detention 3 days a week. And, you know, my parents had more parent-teacher conferences than I'm sure they would have enjoyed, but they went. And, you know, there was never really a follow-up conversation about that stuff when we got home. It wasn't like, hey, you need to do something different or anything. And so I always just say, like, my parents really did the best that they could with what they had. They didn't really have the skill set. You know, my mom didn't really have a childhood herself, and so she wasn't really prepared to transmit something that she hadn't received. And so thankfully, through this program and through all the step work I've done, I have an excellent relationship with my mother today. My father has passed away, but I have a great relationship with my mother, and we talk about everything. And honestly, through the work that I have done, there's been immense healing for our relationship, but then also for a lot of things that happened in her childhood, just in me working a program. So I always think it's super cool to see what God does when we're willing to just own our part and be vulnerable about the things that we have really done to others, how he just uses that in miraculous ways. But I took my first drink when I was 11, and I had this annoying neighbor kid that was, I mean, he just drove me nuts, right? And so it was like summertime, and we weren't doing anything, and I went over to his house, and his mom had a bottle of Crown Royal under the sink, and I don't know, I guess I thought maybe he would get in trouble if we drank it, and so I was willing to drink it just to get him in trouble because that's how much I couldn't stand this kid. And all I remember is I did 5 shots in a row of Crown Royal, and I went home. I don't know what happened the rest of the day. I have no idea. All I know is I went home. I have no concept of anything else that happened, but my alcoholic mind, like, I had a sense that I had won for some reason, like I had defeated him. And in my mind, like, this whole grandiose idea had happened that really never even happened. And I didn't start drinking regularly until I was 13. And that was like that moment where I fell in love. When I took a drink at a girlfriend's house when I was 13, there was a handful of us having a slumber party, and we had, you know, robbed the liquor cabinet. And I took that drink, and I'm telling you, as soon as that hit my system, it was like the whole world slowed down. I had lived my whole life kind of like with my shoulders up here, scared, afraid, running like that, just trying so hard to fit in. And I just relaxed, and we had the music playing, and we started dancing, and I mean, everything was great. And that was it. That was the moment for me. And that was when I just was like, "That I'm ready. Let's do this. Like, can we do this next weekend? What are y'all doing the weekend after that? Who knows somebody that can get some more alcohol for us?" I mean, and that was, I was pretty much just off to the races and ready to just party whenever I had a chance. And as it progressed, I mean, I started to do other things along with alcohol. I would say most of my teenage years was like house parties at friends. My sister was older, and so we would go to, my mom was, when my parents got divorced, my dad moved out, and my mom would say, just take your sister with you. That's what she would tell my sister when my sister was going to hang out with her friends. And so at 15, I ended up at a lot of house parties and was just getting annihilated. And I remember this one time I was there with my boyfriend at the time, and I had drank so much that he was like carrying me around everywhere, right? Because this is the kind of person that I am when I drink. I never have been a person that only had one or two drinks. Like, I always went over the line. I always got annihilated. Like, I was always trying to get somewhere. So I do not identify with the moderate drinker because that was never me. That's just not my experience. But he was like carrying me around all night, and I could hardly stand up. And finally he said, I'm just going to lean you up against this wall right here because my arm is so tired of holding you up. And I was like, okay, whatever. And I'm telling you, he leaned me up, turned around, and it was like a tree. Timber! And I passed out on the floor for like 2 hours while people just walked around me at the party, came to and drank some more, threw up, drank some more. I mean, like, that was just the way that I drank, and that was the way that I started drinking. And for me, I have a gap in my story where I didn't really drink for 5 years. So when I turned 16 and I got my driver's license, Mothers Against Drunk Driving was really popular when I was a kid, and they really drove that in. And so I thought I shouldn't drink and drive. However, I found a lot of outside substances that I started doing because nobody ever told me that I shouldn't take rips from the bong while driving down the street. And I'm not going to get into that a lot because this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but that's just how my life was. And my entire high school experience was I never went to school sober. I slept through second period every day. Like, that's just my life. And I spent all my time after school either going to work or trying to make money to get more of what I needed in order to feel okay, because I never felt okay. And I ended up getting into, well, I started dating this guy whom I should have known when I first met him. Of course, it was love at first sight because everything about him really disturbed me and I couldn't stand him and he annoyed the crap out of me. So I felt like we should fall in love. Because that's how I roll. I take hostages. And I find, like, the worst dude. Like, I'm a magnet for crappy dudes. But, except my husband is really great. I will tell you that. But, and so we start dating, and I was working at Subway at the time, and he was breaking into houses for a living. So when I was 17, I got arrested for, breaking into houses, although I didn't break into anybody's house. I did help, though, so I'm guilty. And I did 6 months in the county jail, and I got out, and I went to some AA meetings in there, and my grandfather used to write me letters, and I would call him once a week, and he would take my call. He wouldn't talk to me, like, the whole time because it's collect, but he would talk to me for about 5 minutes, and then but we were exchanging letters, and he would say things like, if it causes a problem, it is a problem. If you're in jail before you're legally old enough to drink, you might have a problem. And so he never told me I had a problem, but he was 12-stepping me the whole time. It took me years before I realized that. When I got out of jail, they were very excited. They had a box full of AA literature, and they were ready to just, you know, get me in meetings and take me places. And I just really wasn't sure. I mean, jail to me was, ironically, something I adapted really well to, and it's kind of terrifying to admit that. Like, I adapted really well to being with crackheads and prostitutes. You know, that's just the state of where my mind was at the time, and so I apparently liked it so much that I went back another year later and did 6 months, and for me, I would go to jail, and I would move away, and I would do well. And then I would move back home and start hanging out with the same old friends, and I would tank. And so after the third time that that happened, my probation officer was like, you can't live here anymore. I'm going to ban you from the county. You need to find somewhere else to live. And so both of my parents lived in that county, and my mom had already had to move because that first time I got arrested involved one of my neighbors, and they told her that she was no longer welcome to live in that neighborhood anymore. And so she had already relocated once for me and wasn't really willing. She was doing tough love by this point, which she had every right to do. And so I ended up moving in with my cousin and her husband. And they took me in, and I lived with them for about a year. And they wouldn't charge me rent, but they made me get a job. They made me do all the outpatient treatment and go to probation. And my cousin just stayed on my butt, and I got out of the system. And I'm telling you, like, by the skin of my teeth, I got out of the system because I tried. I mean, I went to meetings. I don't want to give the impression that I had any sobriety or worked a program. I had an Alcoholics Anonymous book, like the big book that I have now. I owned for 10 years before I ever opened it and read anything out inside of it. I dusted it on my shelf while I drank a lot of alcohol, but I didn't read any of it. So I went to meetings, but I never got a phone number. I never worked a step or did anything to actually produce sobriety in my life. I was just real dry. And I just gotta give credit to all of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that listened to me. I was in there sharing, like, step six. I'm in there sharing on steps. I have no idea what step six really is. I've not worked any program. Like, the only thing I know about step six is that we read how it works at the beginning of every meeting. And, you know, and they just let me be a train wreck, honestly. And they gave me a lot of grace and a lot of compassion, and they didn't shoot me down, you know. They... one thing that I can say is super awesome about Alcoholics Anonymous is that, you know, you can't, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And in AA, we don't move the bucket. You know, we keep the bucket in the same place. We keep the meetings open for a long time, and then when people are ready for real, they know where to go, and that's kind of been my story. And so I didn't drink for this 5 years, but I did a lot of outside issues, which caused me to go in and out of jail. And so I remember on my 21st birthday, like a good alcoholic, at midnight you turn 21, and so I was working at a Mexican restaurant at the time, and I sat down at the bar of that restaurant, and they put a margarita in front of me. And I remember thinking to myself, this is a bad idea. Nothing good is going to come from this. Are you sure you really want to drink that? And, I mean, I must have stared at that thing for a good 15 minutes before I just had no defense. And I drank it, and it was 2-3 weeks before I was drinking 5-6 nights a week. You know, it really didn't take long because I was primed and ready, and I needed something. And so I spent that time drinking and partying and going to nightclubs. I mean, I was 21, so I just thought, you know, this is what people my age do. This is perfectly age appropriate to be annihilated 6 days a week, to lose your keys trying to stumble home to your apartment that's two blocks from the bar. Like, all of this is perfectly normal. Normal people wake up and don't know where they are in a house full of people that they don't know. I mean, like, it's very age appropriate, and I believed that for a long time. I really thought that that was the truth, and I got into the point where I was drinking more than I could afford to pay my rent, and I, at the time, called it, I backed myself into a corner, but we all know this as the geographical cure. And so I took a road trip with two of my friends and stopped in Atlanta to visit one of my friend's friends. And he was saying that he wanted to transfer to the tech school downtown, Georgia Tech, and he needed a roommate because he couldn't afford to live in Buckhead without a roommate. And I was like, I mean, when? So I packed up all my stuff and 2 months later moved to Georgia with a trailer full of my stuff, and we lived together for about 15 months as roommates. And after that, he had had enough of being around me. I mean, he would wake up at 3 a.m. and there'd be strangers in the living room and we'd be doing God knows what. And, you know, he got tired of having to kick people out that would get violent at 3 a.m. And, you know, he was just tired of my shit. And so he didn't want to be my roommate anymore. And by then, my drinking obviously had been just progressing. And so now it's like I'm drinking all the time. When I transferred to my job to Georgia, I was making a lot less money than I was making in Michigan. And while I had a roommate, I knew I had to pay my rent, but I hadn't paid my car in months. So when I stopped living with him, I really didn't have any place to go. And so I started sleeping on people's couches. And then eventually my car got repoed, and I didn't have a place to live or a car to drive, and I was just kind of at the whim of whatever I could, you know, work out for that night. And the interesting thing is that in 1 week, everything changed in that aspect, and I got a job at the Hard Rock Cafe downtown Atlanta and an apartment in the same week, and I made really good money there, and I actually really enjoyed it. I waited tables and bartended for about 10 years before I had kids, but I worked at the Hard Rock for about 2.5 years, and I really liked it. It was one of my favorite jobs. I mean, it was a bunch of alcoholics, but they were all, like, good at their job, and we had a lot of fun, and you know, I was still, like, dead on the inside. You know, we would all rush to hurry up and get done after closing so that we could make it to last call, because I had to make it to last call. You know what I mean? We would send somebody out that got off earlier that night to go to the liquor store and get bottles for us so that we could party till 6 a.m. I mean, this was what we did every day. And, you know, I think my soul just was dying. You know, I lived in that dark hole of suck. I mean, I woke up every morning wondering, why am I keep doing this? Why is this my life? I'm not going to drink today. By 3 o'clock, I'm definitely drinking. Who's partying with me? You know, and it was the same thing. Wash, rinse, repeat every day. And I just really was starting to hate myself. I mean, like, I had never really liked myself, but I was starting to question whether or not I even wanted to live. And this is kind of the time in my life where I met my husband. And it's interesting. He's the only person I've ever dated that's not been one of us. But when I met him, he looked like a duck, and he walked like a duck, and he partied like one. And so we spent the entire year of our dating getting annihilated, partying and doing all the things. And after about a year of dating, I was pregnant. And so we, you know, did like every other, he's a Georgia boy, so he did like every good Southern boy, and he married me. So we got pregnant in October, and we got engaged in November, married in January, bought a house in March, and had a baby in June. And then I was the suburban housewife, and I have always lived in the city. Mind you, I was able to not drink through my pregnancy. However, I don't remember being that miserable in my entire life. Like, you take a dry drunk and throw in a crap ton of hormones, and it is like a crap show 24/7. Like, I have memories of, like, crawling around on the floor, like, huge pregnant, crying, sobbing. I mean, like, it was ridiculous. Like, there was no sanity at all. And, you know, poor guy, he didn't have any idea what to do. He just thought, you know, pregnant women are crazy. So we had our son, and I think this was probably an indication for my husband. We came home from the hospital, and he was in the carrier, and he was asleep. And we got inside the house, and we set him down, and we're like, we can't believe they let us leave the hospital with this child. And he looked at me, and he was like, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want to drink. Like, it's been, well, not 9 months, because I didn't know I was pregnant for the first month. So it's been 8 months since I've had a drink, and I need a drink. Like, I've been watching you hang out and have a good time this whole time. So, like, that's what we did. We, you know, and I think for him it was kind of like, really? Like, that's weird. And so it was just, that's where I started, you know. And so then I became Betty Crocker, Susie Homemaker, of trying to be good mom all day and take care of my baby and make sure I made a good dinner and I had dinner on the table at the same time every night and my house was clean and I did play dates. And after I put my kid to bed every night, I got wasted, and I was lucky if I could make it till then. I mean, sometimes it was, oh, I'll start with wine at dinner because that's classy, right? You know, and I was just dying all day to make it to when I put my son to bed, because that's how I could say that I was still a decent parent. And I was dying inside. And I really didn't know how to be a mom, and I didn't know how to stay home. And I mean, it's just not my thing. Like, I'm not very good at it. The infant phase is not my thing. I'm a good mom today, but that's because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the women that have really helped me learn how to be a mother. So we did this for about 9 months, and when my son was 9 months old, my dad passed away. He got a cold, and he never went to the doctor. He probably hadn't been to the doctor in 20 years. He had smoked two packs a day forever, and, you know, like, he was the Marlboro man. And he got a cold, and he never went to the doctor until he was, like, bluish-grayish, his skin was, from lack of oxygen. Well, he had pneumonia, and his kidneys were failing, and, I mean, so many things. They found out that he had colon cancer, he had diabetes, and just because he had not been to the doctor in so long, his body couldn't fight it off, and so it just started shutting down, and they had to keep him sedated the whole time. And so I flew up to Michigan, and my in-laws took my son for 3 weeks while I sat in the hospital for 2 weeks with my sister and my dad and his wife. And I watched my dad die. And then we spent the next week taking care of my stepmom, because he had not been good with his finances, and their home was in foreclosure. And so my dad died, and my stepmother didn't have a place to live in a week, because they were hoarders and their home was in foreclosure and he hadn't paid any bills. And we didn't find any of this out until, while he was in the hospital, started opening all the mail and found this out. And so we had to have an estate sale, and I mean, it was just insane. And I would go to the hospital all day. Like, I would wake up in the morning and put something in my system so I could function, I would go to the hospital all day, and then I would go to the bar and drink until I passed out. And I did this, like, every day for 2 weeks straight. And I'm not really sure how that worked, but I will tell you that I don't remember his funeral at all. I know that my cousin gave me some pills that she had, and she's not even one of us, but she was like, "You look like you need something." She felt sorry for me. And I don't remember any of his funeral because I was just lit out of my mind floating around that place. I had no idea. And that was kind of the beginning of the end for me. I spent the next 6 months trying to just not drink all day and being very unsuccessful. I will say that God is, you know, you can always go back and see where the hand of God was in your life the whole time that you were just being so stupid and careless. And my husband, his job ended up bringing him working from home. And so I'm so grateful for that because I could not care for my child. I couldn't stay sober long enough to be able to make his lunch or produce his breakfast. You know, my husband would get me out of bed and pour me on the couch with a hangover. He'd put my son in front of the TV with some Cheerios while I laid out trying to just nurse my hangover. And then I would try and put some kind of lunch together, and I would start drinking. Like, I couldn't go all day. I couldn't be that mom that only drank when my kid was in bed. And I went to have a play date with one of my friends, and I was having a really hard time, and I showed up, and I was just bawling and falling apart, and I knew that I couldn't keep going the way that I was, and I didn't know how to process any of the things that I felt. And she invited me to go to her church with her, and I went into this service, and I share this because this was the first time that I had ever had a spiritual experience in my life. I was not raised going to church. We never talked about God or anything like that in the home that I grew up. My parents had a Bible. It sat on the shelf. We dusted it every Saturday with all the rest of the books, and that was my extent of knowledge of spirituality, higher power, God, church, religion, all of that. I didn't have any of that. And so when I went to this service with her, I felt like everybody could see right through me. Like, I felt like, you know, all these people were like, "Oh, she's a sinner." But when I sat down in that service and we started singing, I felt the presence of God come over me like a warm blanket fresh out of the dryer. I mean, it was just, I had never felt that. I had always been very agnostic. I mean, if God works for you, that's great. I mean, I'm sure there's probably something out there. But I'm telling you, this presence came over me and I wept like a baby. And I cried and cried and cried because I knew at that moment that God was real. And this is like a real pivotal point for me, because while that moment and getting saved and baptized did not stop my drinking, it encouraged me to try and stop drinking. And now, I had always thought that I could stop if I wanted to. I just didn't want to. And that's the lie or the delusion that I had told myself all those years. Like, I mean, if I wanted to stop, I'd just stop. I just don't want to. And lo and behold, when I tried to stop or decided I'm going to stop or at least slow down or moderate, right, I couldn't. I couldn't stop. And I did that for about 2 or 3 months. I played with it, and I'd get 2 or 3 days here, 4 days there. I think one time I got 5 days where I hadn't had a drink, and I mean, I was white-knuckling it. I have this one moment that I remember so vividly, standing in my kitchen. And I had put dinner on the table, and it was all laid out, my little Betty Crocker meal, right, trying to prove that it was okay by changing things outside of me. And I'm, like, just standing there, and every muscle is clenched, and I am, like, literally driving my fingernails into my palm. I hadn't had a drink in, like, 4 or 5 days, and I looked at my husband, and I was like, "Don't look at me. Don't talk to me. I am not capable of thinking. I am not capable of a conversation. Like, all I know is I haven't had a drink, and I need a drink, and I'm trying not to, and I'm doing the best I can." And he looked at me with pity. I mean, like, it was just straight pity. There's no way to sugarcoat it. And he felt so sorry for me that he was like, "Just go. Just go." You know, he didn't know what else to do for me. And I went. I went to the bar, and I threw it down as fast as I could. You know, I mean, I sat down, and I was like, "I need a shot and a drink. Like, I'm not messing around. Give me another shot. Like, I need to get somewhere fast because I cannot stay here." And after about 2 or 3 months of trying to do it on my own, I crawled myself back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will say it's been a crazy and wild ride. I cried at every meeting I went to for the first 90 days at least. I'm a sharer, so I shared a lot. Even though I probably didn't know what I was talking about, I'm sure I shared a lot of mess as opposed to message, but I was really seeking, and I ran through the steps. Like, I got a sponsor. I ran through the steps like my ass was on fire, because it was on fire, and I needed some relief. And so I can't say that my first time through the steps was the deepest work that I've done, but it was the best that I could do and as thoroughly as I could do at the time. It was what I needed, because I needed some immediate relief in order to not go home and kill myself, because I just couldn't go that way. Like, I ended up back in AA because it was either I'm going to give this thing a try and it's going to work, or I'm going to off myself because I'm not living this way anymore. And so I'm grateful the obsession was removed rather quickly. I'm grateful for the sponsor I had at the time, because she allowed me to go through the steps so quickly. By the time I had 90 days sober, I was making amends. I was doing my fourth step at 30 days sober. I mean, I just ran through it. I ended up in about a year sober, I ended up in a big book study that we did at somebody's home. And that was when I worked the steps the second time, and I really got that deep experience, and I got a lot of freedom through working the steps with those women, and it was truly amazing. I will say, like, a lot of things got better. I mean, of course, at first my husband was like, now you're gone all the time to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I did 90 and 90. In fact, I did, if I could get 2 meetings in a day, I would do that. Like, if I could put my kid down for a nap and hit the noon meeting, I would do that. And then I'd go back again later for the 8 o'clock meeting. I ran to Alcoholics Anonymous like I ran to the bottle, because I did not know how to feel anything, and I would feel something and I would get terrified and run to an AA meeting. That was just the way that I got sober. And at first it was a little like, you're gone all the time at these meetings, and you know, that was really hard for us, but he already had 1 foot out the door. He was done with all my shenanigans, and so I had to do what I had to do for me. And I mean, we are still married today. We have a great marriage and a wonderful family. And you know, it's just, I don't want to negate the fact, if you're new in sobriety, it's hard. It's really hard, and your spouse might not understand. And, you know, I felt like I was abandoning my kid going to meetings all the time, but it's really the best thing that I did. And I know we say 90 and 90, but somebody actually in this room said, what about 365, 365? And I kind of stepped up to that. I was like, you know, I think that might be something that I could really handle, because I'm pretty crazy and I could use a little more sanity in my life. And for some reason, that hour when I was in the meeting, I almost always felt better in that hour. Almost always. I can't say every single time, because sometimes I would go to like a women's meeting at 6:30 and then stay for the 8 o'clock because I still felt nutty. But I almost always felt more peace in the meeting, and so I ran there, and I went to a meeting at least once a day for the first 9 months, and then even for the last 3 months of my year, went 5 or 6 days a week, because that was what I needed in order to stay sane. And so fast forward to about, I mean, everything's hunky-dory, right? Like, things are going good, I'm not drinking, so things must be great. But at about a year and a half sober, my husband and I started arguing again like we did when I was drinking. And, you know, I had done a lot of work on myself and my drinking, but what we hadn't looked at was the problems that we had in our marriage and our relationship. And so we got to that jumping off place where it was either go ahead and get divorced or work on it and make it work. And the reason we got to that place is because we got into an argument where the police ended up at my house at a year and a half sober, because, you know, that's always super great that you want to tell people, yes, I'm sober, and the police are still at my house, yay. But they ended up here, and they were like, listen, figure it out, because next time we come, we're going to take your kid. Like, you guys, this is going to escalate, and somebody's going to put their hands on somebody else, and then we're going to come and take your kid, because that's what we do. And it really motivated us, and we decided we were going to make it work. And so we did about a year of intense marriage counseling and just working on a lot of the issues in between us. And I'm super grateful that I had a spouse that was willing to step into that with me, that was willing to fight for our marriage, because for me, there was really no point in being happy, joyous, and free all by myself. I really wanted to build a life with him and a future for our kid at the time. And so we worked on that. I want to say about the 3-year mark in sobriety, that was like the sweet spot for me. My kid was like 4 or 5, and so I had a little bit more freedom, and I was sponsoring all these girls, and I mean, I just felt like you could have gave me a superhero cape. Like, I was super AA. I was going into the prisons and taking meetings. I'm telling you, if you guys want to feel a rush, you want to feel something that you have never felt before, go and get locked into a prison for a couple hours and then get let back out. I'm telling you, you will never be more grateful than you are after leaving a meeting of sharing experience, strength, and hope with people that are behind bars. It is truly amazing. And I did that for a couple years, pretty much every Thursday night, until I got pregnant with my second child. And once I started showing, I had 3 people in the same week tell me that it made them nervous that I still went into the prison. And while I felt comfortable, this program had taught me that it wasn't fair for me to steal other people's peace and comfort for my selfishness of wanting to share Alcoholics Anonymous with the women behind bars. And so I had to step away from doing that while I was pregnant. And, you know, God gave me other ways that I could still carry the message. It's not like that was the only way that I could do it. And so it was good. It helped me to broaden my horizons and kind of stretch out and share the message in other ways. I had my second son. I went completely insane, and had it not been for the Women Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have lost my mind completely, because they came over and they made me meals, and they helped me bathe my kids when my husband was out of town for work. They swept my floors. They took my children every week at the same time for 2 or 3 hours just so I could take a nap or take a shower or have my sanity. Because that child, I'm telling you, he screamed for the first 13, 15 months of his life. I mean, it didn't matter what you did. We would rock and bounce and sway and sing, and he was just screaming the whole time. He never wanted to be on the outside. He was perfectly happy in the womb, and he couldn't believe that I would have taken him out of that place, his happy little cozy bun. And so I lost my mind, and you know, we really had to work out a system so that I could make AA a priority, make attending meetings a priority. Just because I had an infant at home, my sponsor really pushed me to not make that an excuse to not make meetings. And I'm grateful that she really guided me through that, you know, because I would have not done as many meetings. And I took him to women's meetings, where they played past the baby. They were perfectly happy to hold a baby the entire meeting. I, however, just wanted to sit there and not hold a baby for 1 hour a day. And so what I learned is that I am not built for the infant stage. It takes a lot of selflessness to nurture a newborn, a baby. I prefer the toddler stage and older, where I can run around and make them squeal like a pig and chase them. Like, that is my sweet spot. Babies need a lot, and I am a selfish and self-centered alcoholic, so that's not always so easy for me. So I'm super grateful for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that really carried me through that. And then I spent the next couple of years really just like doing the deal and sponsoring people and, you know, trying to figure out how to be a mom of 2. And I feel like we always have something that we're trying to balance, like work and family and Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to be of service and work with sponsors. I mean, it's like the never-ending juggle, right? And putting my sobriety first. And, you know, I'm a person, like my sponsor says, we work the steps, and then we work the steps, and then we work the steps. So I'm always working on something and trying to seek my higher power on another level. And then about 7 years sober, God asked me to do something that for the first time in my sobriety, I said no. And my sponsor, she took me in the back door to an Al-Anon weekend. She said it was it's an AA conference with Al-Anon participation. And we got there, and it was an Al-Anon conference with AA participation. And I listened to speakers all weekend talk about things, and I kept identifying other people that I know, especially in my family. Oh, my husband does this, or my cousin does that, or my mom does that thing. And that Sunday morning speaker got up and told my story. And he talked about how his mom passed on the disease of Al-Anon just in the way that she raised him. And I thought, oh, crap. And so God was asking me to heal from the effects of alcohol that I had stepped into, that I had just been raised in, from all the people that I had dated, from all the friends that I had. And I really wasn't willing to look at that. And so what that did for me, I went to a couple of meetings, and I decided that I wasn't going to do it, and I walked away. And when I walked away, I started working the program backwards. I told God no, so I stopped working with sponsees very much. I stopped praying and meditating. I stopped doing a 10th step. I was not as willing to see my error in things, and so therefore step 9 and all the action steps were out the window. All I did was go to meetings. And I got to the point where I wanted to drink again. Now, I went to that convention in February. About 6 months later in August, I was so desperate. I wanted to drink again. I was saying things like, I could see how people could drink again. And somebody that I knew said that, and they had went back out. And it scared the crap out of me when I heard that they went back out, and I was saying the same things that she was saying. And I went to my home group, and I was like, y'all, I want to drink. And I'm not working a program, and I'm going to meetings, and I don't know what happened, because I really didn't know. I couldn't put them together for the longest time. It took a lot of conversations with people after meetings and questioning me and saying, you know, how did you end up here? You didn't just wake up pounding on the bar like, how did I get here? There was like actions that you took. You put this path in place to end up in the place where you wanted to drink again so desperately. And I figured out that it was my unwillingness to step into God's will for my life. And so I began my journey with Al-Anon. And I know this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but for me, I share this because it's so intertwined that it caused me to want to drink again. And I had to work intensely for 6 months before I could just find my feet. It took me 3 months of intense work to be able to not be driven by the obsession to drink. It took me another 2 or 3 months before I could feel like my feet were on the ground again. And it took a long time. And I just share this because a lot of times we say the newcomer, and the newcomer is very important, but that still suffering alcoholic could be somebody that has time. It could be somebody with 20 years sober, and we don't always talk about that a lot. And we see people with a lot of time that do go back out. And I just want to encourage you guys, like, make sure that you're asking everybody how they're doing, you know? Like, yes, reach out to the newcomers, but sometimes it's the person with time that really has some hard work to do, some causes and conditions to get down to, some of that stuff that's really hard to look at. Some of the abuse that I had endured through relationships was really hard for me to be willing to process through. And I really didn't want to do that, but that's what it took for me to be able to stay sober. And that's what it takes today. Today I have to work 2 programs because I don't just wake up normal. I wake up half crazy and have to try and work myself into sanity. You know, that's just the reality of my situation, and I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous that has never given up on me. As long as I'm willing to step into the room and be vulnerable and say, this is where I am, it's not a pretty place, it's really crappy and it's dark, somebody from the program always reaches in and shines a light and says, hey, this is the path over here, follow me, and we can get back out. And I love that about Alcoholics Anonymous. It has never let me down. It has solved every problem that I had ever had and has given me a God that I can stand firm in, that I rely on today, that I need, like, air, which we just read with a sponsee the other day, step 11, that we can't do without air and sunshine, and I can't do without prayer and meditation and Alcoholics Anonymous, just like I can't do without air. And so I have an amazing life today because of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, a life that is far beyond anything that I could have imagined for myself. Definitely not what I thought that I would have had, but obviously one that my higher power thinks I'm worthy of. And for that, I'm grateful. Thanks for letting me share.
around in circles, grin upside down. Falling off the edge just don't sound like fun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone. Ought to learn a lesson, breaking all the rules. Try a listening session, the guilty love that fools. Sleep away the day, hiding from the sun. We gotta stop fighting everything, everyone.